let's get ready to the extent that one could be ready for Rav Judah. I just want to again thank Rav Judah for coming. He comes each and every year, even though he has an extremely, extremely demanding and difficult job over the summer, a very important service to Klal Yisrael that he does, and yet he still makes time to come share Torah with us in Camp Keli, and that's really important for us because Baruch Hashem, we have so many great Talmidei Chacham that come through, but there are very few people that you could say are mamish one of a kind, and someone who speaks directly to us, to our neshamos, and in every man kind of way, and yet shares with us some of the most beautiful insights into ourselves and into the way the world works in such an easygoing kind of way that just talks to us. So it's a highlight of my summer when Rav Judah comes, and it's a highlight of all the Kelim Masvidim summer. So I just want to give Hakaras HaTov to Rav Judah for again sharing with us his Divrei Torah, his Chizuk, and just for being Rav Judah. Just we love you. All right. That was the main reason why, that was the main reason I came. I appreciate it. I'm being serious.
Yeah.
What?
If
I...
No.
Ball and basket, I can get by me. I thought I was going to get something, a little something. I got to speak to Ellie, to Brazil. Yeah. Ball and basket, I can get in the shop right in Parksville.
Yeah.
I'll get a little something. Polish Spring something over here. Okay, Erev Tov, everyone. Yeah, come on. You didn't have to say the whole reference. It was enough. Remiza, that's the main thing. Erev Tov, everyone. This is very special to be back here. Thank you very much. It's just Harabonim. The Avnei Basi, the stones and the walls of our home will testify that that between myself and Ora, my wife, you can hear on a daily basis. You hear Rabbi Leibowitz on a daily basis. And on a weekly basis, you hear Rabbi Rosner and Rabbi Marcus Klein in the house, in the kitchen. There's like a... These are the voices of Torah in our house. You throw a little Moshe Tzvi in there, and that's it. This is it. This is for our family. The Mount Rushmore of Marbitze Torah in our lives on a very practical level. Once in a while you throw a YY in there, just to remind us that we're going to be okay, and then everybody's suffering from trauma and whatever, it's good, and the Rebbe is with us. But these are the voices of Torah in our home and in our lives. And I can't say, I want to bless all of you. You should have the opportunity to learn Torah from such special people. And Asay L'Charav and Kenei L'Chachav, you should be able to have relationships with those people and access to them and know how lucky you are to have them in your lives. It's such a special thing. It's really, really special to be here. It's really, really special to be here. And I was just outside. My summer looks very different. The first time that Rav Chaim and I, we spent summer together, was right after we were married, and we were in Kol, or something, and exactly, Chinuch, Sora, Kol, and thinking back to those summers of being up in the mountains, and having just an upstate Beis Medrash, summertime Beis Medrash, of people who are learning, and being around an environment where you can breathe, and you can just enjoy, and relax, and have a good shmooze with good people and good learning and just a chevrah shabbos. It's such a powerful experience and incubator. You should enjoy it. You should enjoy it and take advantage of it. This is a special, special thing to be able to be a part of. Ashreichem. And especially here. We were just talking outside about how important the mission is that what's taking place all around. I don't know how much your daily schedule allows or includes you in, no pun intended, in the events and activities that are going on around the campus, but understand what's in the water here and what's in the environment over here. Just the sensitivity
to the way that Hashem painted this picture of the Jewish people, the sensitivity that you can acquire and live with, the recognition of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu made every person in such a unique way, in such a special way, to be able to recognize just the Tzelem Elokim in every single person, and the Cheshivas of every single Jew. Sfasama says that's what the entire Torah stands on, the entire construct of Torah. Everything you're learning in here, Torah Shebal Peh, Torah Shebichtav, Musar, Chassidus, and every aspect of Limud HaTorah is to reveal, the Sfasama says, the Tzelem Elokim, the Chain in a Jew. He says that Tzelem is also Tzivalanu Moshe, that the entire operation of Talmud Torah, the Limud HaTorah, the entire Masorah revolves around this as a prerequisite to real Kabbalah Torah. To be able to be learning here, whether or not you're involved in reffing games and being in the bunks, and you have so many opportunities to interact with so many good people and so many Jewish people, and to model what it is to be a person who's sensitive and connected. Ashreichem, to be able to learn Torah in such a place, it's a beautiful thing. Torah Derech Eretz, it's a beautiful thing. Ashreichem. Ashreichem, Ashreichem. Rabbi Simon, the Imre Baruch, we spent Shabbos at the Imre Baruch, which was, we were reminiscing about our time in Mor Shakol in 1978, and I said I actually wasn't there. But he said Rabbi Pollack was there. Another person who works in Haskell said, I wasn't there though. He goes, oh, but Mustafa, he told you about it. So, we talk about a lot of things. We work together every single day, but I haven't heard, you know, whatever. But I don't know if you're learning the Svarim of Rabbi Simon Imre Baruch, this is like, you know, the Shabbos, the week of Chukas, every single year. Come back to this insight that Rabbi Simon shares. It's not on Chukas in the Sefer. I think it's in Lech Lecha, but it's worthwhile to see inside because a very, very Klal Yisrael is. The Sedra recounts our journey. We're in the thick of it. But Midbar is action. It's an action-packed sefer, and we're in process. And you see this like amazing journey that the Jewish people are going through, step by step, to Yerusha Sa'aretz. Everything that we're going through, all the midos, all the mistakes, all the ups, all the downs. It's an unbelievable time to be living with the Sedra, and one after the other. We're coming to Eretz Yisrael. Like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is like saying, okay, it's go time. Those who offered their hand in peace, so we made treaties with, and everything was great. Those who sought our harm, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, brought down his wrath, and the armies of the Jewish people crushed them, one after the other. I mean, you see, there's some real blood and guts in these parashios. In our Sedra, you see Am Yisrael coming up toward the northern, toward the Golan Heights, toward Bashan, on the other side of the Yarden. I feel like if anybody's watching Rabari Waxman's videos, you can get a much better insight as to exactly how this unfolds. But they're coming up the boundary to the Golan Heights. That's Bashan, the other side. These are actually from these psukim, contemporary poskim try to understand Hilchos Shemitah in terms of the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael and Golan Heights and other parts. But they're coming up along the northern border, and as we're marching toward Bashan, meeting armies along the way, so the pasuk says that Og Melech HaBashan, which is that northern part, comes out the Karsam, he comes out to greet us. And he came out of, you know, he came out like to, you know, to make trouble. And Moshe Rabbeinu was leading the armies of the Jewish people, and Og begins to approach. So the Pasuk says a fascinating thing. Yomar Hashem Moshe, Hashem tells Moshe, Al Tirosa. Don't be afraid of him. Don't be afraid. Because I'm going to hand him over to you. I'm gonna empower you. I'm going to hand him over to you. Him and his whole nation and all of his lands, it's all going to be you, and everything that I did to Sichon, Melech Amori, I'm going to also do to Og Melech HaBashan. The Mefarshim try to understand what on earth could Moshe possibly need this reassuring? What can Moshe be afraid of? after everything that Moshe Rabbeinu had gone through, after everything that the Jewish people had experienced, after everything that Moshe not just saw, but he facilitated, all the miracles, all this, all the osos and the mosos, and all the signs of Paro, all the makos. I mean, we sit Seder night and do math. Yeah, that's usually when I offer my mother-in-law help or something, you know, like how many at the sea, we do the multiplication tables and algebra, like trying to figure out how many millions of makos. Moshe Rabbeinu was there, he was doing it. Vayimina Bashem, of Moshe Aldo. Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who was taking care of all of this business. He was, besides for being the greatest prophet and greatest teacher, besides for being the one who saw the Kodesh Baruch Hu, you know, in the most clear way, he was also leading us in battle. And he saw the greatest superpower, Paro, he saw the Mitzrim come to their knees, crumble. So these pyramids, all these incredible accomplishments, all the makos, he saw. And not only that, already, like, we learned already, we've gone through times and stages in recent weeks in our sedra, we're living with it, where Klal Yisrael needed a strengthen our resolve. We sent out some scouts, we sent out some raglim, and he came back with their report, trying to understand the topography, trying to understand like the military situation. They came back and lacked faith in themselves, and we saw what happened there. Not a good end to the story. Look, Moshe Rabbeinu, like, what on earth are you afraid of that you need reassurance? Altir also? Don't be afraid of him? Who is this fellow Og? You remember Og? When the little Medrash says, I don't know, somebody, I remember here Og, I have like this, must have like during Shul when I was younger, like looked at the little Medrash says, like the pictures of Og. Remember him? Where is he from? Huh? The picture in the little Midrash says of them holding on to the side of the ark. Remember that? He's been around for a while. I mean, there's some wild Gemaras. We learned, we were learning Megillah in the afternoon shiur the whole year. There was like, I don't know, days and days and days of Og talk. I mean, I think I like pulled out everything you could possibly find about Og, trying to, when you got up to the Gemara talking about Og, like, a fascinating character, wild stories. I mean, his size, his teeth, with the mountain. I mean, Og was a... But Moshe had faced bigger and he faced better. I mean, Moshe was afraid of Og because he was old, because he had some gravitas, because he had big teeth, because he was tall. I don't know, like, it seems funny. My brother likes to leave the heart like that. Like, he's just like say, yeah, yes, okay. Moshe Chlisha Zadas. Well, what happened? Moshe got nervous. We saw Aaron Cohen a couple weeks ago. Hashem gave him a job to do, and he had Chlisha Zadas. Rashi says, Chal Shadaito. He said, well, I'm lighting the menorah and they're bringing the karbanos. Aaron had a hard time with that. He was looking over his shoulder, and you can explain it 100 different ways. That's why we have so many wonderful mafarshim, bless you, but in the end of the day, there's such a thing as Chalisha Zadas. Sometimes a person gets nervous. Sometimes a person needs reassurance. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, even Aaron Cohen. That's what my brother likes to say. But Rashi, earlier when we meet Og, when we really meet Og in the Psukim, Rashi points out who this person was. What do anybody know here? Like what? Besides for the little Midrash says that he was hanging onto the ark. Textually, think back to Shnai Mikra, or get ready for Shana Bet Shnai Mikra when you're gonna like start a little earlier, you know. I see that resonates with people, so I'm not can't be that off, you know. What happened? Anybody? What do you say?
He warned Avraham that Lot was
excellent.
Yeah. Because he wanted
to. Yeah, so Pasuk says like this: there's a whole world war going on, battle of five kings, of four kings. And a refugee comes from battle. Vayavoa palifa gave Avram Ivri. This refugee comes from the battlefield, and he comes to Avram and says, Lot has been taken captive. Lot was captured. That Rashi says, that palit, it's really the Medrash Rabbah, says, that palit, that refugee was Og. Simon brings from the Azhar Avar, who was a phenomenal goon, came before the war to live in Lower East Side, live in the Bronx, ultimately came to Eretz Israel, lived in Tel Aviv. The Sfarim of the Ozhravar, the Eshtas and the Baron Moshe, the Sfarim that, like, you know, were like the main Sfarim in the generation, like that dealt with issues in Machshava and sorts of philosophy. Revolvi held him, considered him a mentor, considered him Rebbe. I didn't have so much personal interaction with him, but when he was trying to clarify ideas in Ali Shor, he would often consult the Sfarim of the Eshtas. So Ozhravar explains as follows. Moshe Rabbeinu, all these years later, the merit that Og had, he had a schus, because he went and told Avram that his nephew was taken captive. Avram went to go save his nephew. And the schus that Og, that Og Melech HaBasha, the Og, as a young man, helped out Avram Avinu. He did a tova. He did a solid for Avram Avinu, saved his nephew, and Avram went to go rescue him. So in that merit, he had longevity. He lived for generations and generations and generations. And Moshe, all that time later, was concerned that the merit that Og had for doing that chesed, this Rasha Amarusha, a person who did not have a good track record as the king of Bashan, that this individual, that the chesed, that tova that he did for Avraham Avinu was going to stand for him. And Moshe was, in the face of that chesed, in the face of that schus, of that merit, he was concerned.
But what do you ask?
He had bad intentions.
Yeah, I mean, why did Og come and tell Avraham Avinu? Yeah, his plan was very simple, was explicit. Og's intention was nefarious. He came to tell Avraham Avinu that Sarah was taken captive. Avram would go rush out with a few of his chevra. He gets his chevra together, his posse, he runs out into the middle of a war zone. Og's intention was that he would be ambushed, that Avraham Avinu would be killed, and then he'd take his wife. He'd steal his wife. Meaning, his intentions were murderous. His intentions were to rape Sarah Himenu, Chamala Litzlan. That was his intention. Meaning, like, he wasn't like being a good guy. He was being a schemer. It was premeditated, and he had this whole elaborate plan to have Avraham Avinu killed so he could take his wife forcefully. In the end, Avraham Avinu had his guys. He had set up the Shemaya, and Avraham Avinu managed to redeem Lot and bring him back, and he survived. And Og receives reward for that chesed. Says the Ozhravar, learn here from a very, very fun, a very important idea. And sometimes we think that in order to, like, you know, in order to do something, for it to count, you have to do it l'chatchila. It has to be done in, like, the best possible way. And we strive to have intentions that are l'shem shamayim. We strive to do things in a way which honors the mitzvah, the lave of shalom. We strive to do things in a way which is elevated. We want to do things the best possible way to serve Hashem and to help others, l'shma, l'shem shamayim, with good intent, not for kavod, not for kina, not for taiva, not to promote ourselves, not for honor. And sometimes, if the bottom line is the bottom line, if the derivative of our intentions, that sometimes has to do with things, ulterior motives, something which is beyond the purest of intentions, and it helps someone, and it does good in the world, it still counts. It's not binary. Meaning there's a dialect. Of course we want to do Torah mitzvahs, we want to learn Torah in the ultimate form. Of course we want to daven with the most purest of intentions, without pineos. We want our relationship with Hashem to be honest and authentic and real. Of course when we go to go help another yid to do chesed, to perform an act of service or kindness for another person, we want it to be not to get credit, and not to make everyone a hakarai about you, not to get in the papers and be in the Catskill views or whatever it may be. Of course. But Og, intention was to murder and rape. And generations later, Ozhravar says, Moshe Rabbeinu needed to be reassured by the Ribbono Shel Olam, the greatest prophet who ever lived. The most, the human being who reached the level of self-actualization greater than any human being that has ever walked the face of the earth, needed reassurance because he understood what it is, what a schus of doing for a favor for another person is. Even if the intention was bad, even if the whole surrounding narrative was one which was from A to Z, nefarious and cruel, nonetheless, in the end, something good was done for another person. Moshe Rabbeinu was afraid of that. Says Rabbi Nachman Luktimoran, Teida, Ish kazeh shem megushim kol kach. Take a person who's filled with megusham. Doesn't mean that, like, you know, he enjoys a carving station at a simple. Megusham. Somebody who's like their whole thing is are things. To fill themselves and to live a life distracting from meaning and from spirituality. Somebody's megusham. Kol tnuah v'tnuah shumenatek atzma ma'at ma'at ben gashmiyuso. Know that every action, every movement away from the world, which is the gravitational pull toward the material, toward negativity, upona l'Hashem yizbarach, the person turns toward Hashem just a little bit, gedola v'yikara ma'od ma'od. That's precious, that's important, that's valuable to Hashem very, very much. Afilu nekuda ketana ma'od, even a tiny point, beneath layers and layers and layers of ill intent, underneath layers and layers and layers of material and physicality that covers it up to the point that you can't even recognize it. Even just a little bit, hold back from something which is distracting or pulling us away from purposeful living. The impact that creates in the upper worlds, what that does, the distance that we go spiritually, the impact that has in the heavens, and ultimately putting into our personal ecosystem, paying into our bank of merit, and what that puts into the atmosphere, into the world, even just a little bit, even for a moment. Consider how the Vilna Gaon describes holding back from Lashon Hara even for a moment, just for a moment. The infinite schar, the reward, what that accomplishes for us, what that does for us as a person, even for a moment. Big people, and Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest, really, really big people, the bigger we are and the bigger we strive to be and the bigger we imagine and yearn to be, the more we can, it's the more we're able to honor and appreciate little things, or what's considered little things, imperfect things. Small people with narrow vision, people who are a bit stuck in themselves, people know a lot of Torah ideas and accomplish great things in Torah, but haven't tapped into the bigger picture of what it is to be a Yid, the way Hashem runs the world, have a hard time appreciating things that are chasadim, that are incomplete, let's say, or tefillah, or tzedakah, that's maybe tainted by some form of self-interest. But the bigger someone is, the more they can honor and respect that nekuda tova. There are few in Jewish history, certainly in modern Jewish history, who were as big as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and who lived a life with so clearly attached to this yisod. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu, what was his fear? That Hashem had, that the Ribono Shel Olam, that God Himself had to reassure Moshe. Don't, Al Tiroso, don't worry. It's true, Og had a lot of schus, and it's true, I can understand the Havamina about what you're worried about. But even more so is my promise to you that you're going to go into Eretz Israel. You understand? Moshe Rabbeinu understood how powerful it is. How much one can accomplish, how much one accomplishes in the upper world, the schus that creates, just by creating a world where somebody was helped, where he did for another person. And Og was only thinking about himself. This Shabbos was Gimel Tammuz, still in the zone. I'm in the zone most of the year. Gimel Tammuz again. The Rebbe, if nothing else, the Rebbe's impact was a message to us and to the entire world to value a positive movement, to value a holy intent, to value a mitzvah, regardless of what's taking place surrounding that moment. The moment a person engages in mitzvah, regardless of the canvas in which that moment is painted on, the context, putting on that pair of tefillin for a moment in the street, lighting those Shabbos candles regardless of what takes place before or after. Sitting down and learning a piece of Torah, regardless of what where a person's up to in the rest of their Jewish life of Jewish engagement, is meaningful, it's purposeful, it's real, it's eternal. And light is stronger than darkness. My parents started their journey in observance. My father had put on tefillin for his bar mitzvah, and there was a time lapse between that and when he got to college. It wasn't part of like the daily ritual. He didn't own a pair of tefillin, but they had part of the ceremony in the shul in Queens. That was over there. But my mother hadn't seen the tzura, the form of the letters Aleph Beis. She didn't see it. It wasn't something that wasn't exposed. It was in the house. There was no book in the house that had Jewish writing in it. And they didn't belong to a shul. My grandfather went. I asked him. I was very young. I don't remember exactly, but like I probed a little bit when I was younger, because I couldn't fully understand, like, you know, enjoy the lucky charms at the house, but I didn't fully understand, like, you know, what the, like, how all these pieces were coming together, whatever. Mayaseh bench lo yechta, you know what I'm saying? Also, I was an eater, you know what I'm saying? I am an eater, I'm a fresher. Everybody has their, I have many yitzharas, that is one of them. And they didn't belong to a shul. My grandfather went to Yom Kippur, he said, like, my grandmother said, like, go to Yom Kippur, like, it was a second marriage, like, he was an older man, Russian. It's like he didn't like the reform show was stupid, but like I don't know exactly what the story was, but they had very strong Jewish hearts and very strong, you know, ironically a strong Jewish identity without any of the vessels, without any of the details. And my parents met the first time. My father came to my grandma's house, like they served surf and turf. It wasn't like there was very little sensitivity to the details of Torah Mitzvah and the beginning of their journey in college at a very tumultuous time in American history, in world history. The world was upside down. The parents met, depending on if there's different opinions, like this is because it's, thank God, now we're living a life of Torah, we're striving to, so there's different opinions, you know, in the ratio and the safe for them. So according to my mother, they met. My father was hitchhiking on the way to a Jefferson Airplane concert, and my mother and her friends picked him up on the road on a Friday night. My father maintains, though, that the first time they met was at a rally when people were taking over the student union and burning draft cards in 1970, and the state police came. There was more violence, more hippie police violence in the University of Buffalo than anywhere else other than Kent State. And Kent State, they opened fire on the students, meaning like that's where they were holding. And so when they started, like slowly but surely, there's a Chabad shliach there, Rabbi Gerari, should be well. My father worked in the student union, long hair, the whole thing. And Rabbi Gerari said, "Hey, you're a Jew?" My father looked at him and said, "Yeah." And how did you know? So he said, "Oh, come on, of course you're." So they started talking, and he says, "Come, why don't you put on tefillin?" So my father said, "What would happen if I wasn't what if I wasn't a Jew?" Yes, my father said, "I'm not a Jew." He goes, "I would have invited you over for a l'chaim, but I wouldn't have given you tefillin." So my father got the tefillin and the l'chaim. This guy was a 24-year-old guy. He just moved to Buffalo. He's like a couple years older than him, you know. He knew Aleph, so he's teaching Aleph. Like the Rebbe said, he was out there with Mesiras Nefesh the next half a century. And my father didn't have any money, so they would go on dates. My father schlepped my mother to the Chabad house, University of Buffalo. They didn't have any money either. So they had like challah, the Rebbe's a big challah. And at that point in history yet, the importance of the world was in such a state that they hadn't yet revealed the secret of dips. But they would have challah rolls. And that's why in our generation, that's the final rectification before redemption. But they'd have challah rolls. The Rebbe's would make challah. And then they'd have like hot dogs and rice, because that's what they could afford. They didn't have any money. Gefilte fish, my father's like, "Gefilte fish?" And then like, you know, some they'd zmiros, they'd drink vodka, like really like vodka. Then they would eat hot dogs and rice. Like the last of svara is why they'd have the vodka. Like my father said, originally they explained to us that it was because after the fish, before you have the meat. He's like, really, the hot dogs were such cheap, like cheap hot dogs and rice, like they want everyone to just like not notice it. And as they began their Shabbos journey, and at a certain point, like they were getting married, and before they got married, they were getting married in Reform
they're going to get married to Reform Shul in Sofer near my grandparents' shul, the shul that they didn't, the Reform Shul they didn't even go to. But that's where they had a catering hall, they're going to get married there. And I only found this out like 2 days before my Ofer. I had no idea. I asked my father, would you mind if like I started davening Sechari, if I was a Gartel, whatever, do you mind? He's like, do whatever you want. You do whatever you want anyway. Like, all of a sudden you're asking me, like, I said, I think there's a formality. If like, ask your father, I'm like, there's a process here. He's like, yeah. He's like, I did what I want, you do what you want, you know? He goes, but if you have, he said, if you want like a, if you want like a bigger Gartel, I have one. I said, what are you talking about, a Gartel? What Gartel do you have? Father said, I got it at my wedding. Rabbi Gerari gave it to me at my wedding. I said, Rabbi Gerari, is it your wedding? Like, I've seen we have a picture. My dad has long hair and tuxedo in the Reform Shul, which is now a yeshiva in Sofron, by the way. It turned to like, you know, all these places are like, you know, Hasidic places. You know, this is before Airmont and Pomona. This is like, you know, and there was no from people in Spring Valley and Sofron. It wasn't a thing. So I said, what are you talking about? You know, my son, this is wild. Father said, yeah. He's like, yeah, I never mentioned it. I'm like, man. He's like, yeah. But like 2 days before our wedding was scheduled to suffer, like Rabbi Gerari and Rabbi Greenberg with the two shluchim, you know, told me and your mom, like, you know, we're going to go for a ride. They were like, or like 3 days before, they were in Buffalo and they were going to go down to New York for the wedding. And Rebbetzin Greenberg and Rebbetzin Gerari took my mother in one car, and the two shluchim took my father in another car. And they had been like, you know, on campus for 2.5 years they were together. It wasn't like, you know, 3 dates in Yala. You know, they were very close. Like, they grew up, they were growing up together. My parents were like, you know, they were like, you know, 24. It's like, you know, like, and they took they went down to 770. And they took my mother, where a woman goes before she gets married, and to have yechidus with the Rebbe. And they took my father, you know, they said, we're going to put you in the mikveh. He goes, no. He goes, I'm going to go in the mikveh when I'm dead. He goes, he'd read the book. He's like, I know, when I'm dead, you put me in there. I'm not doing that with you before that. They said, no, come on, Howie, come on. It's going to be good for the wedding. He's like, okay, fine. And then he thought it was just going to be like, you know, something where they're going to learn, prepare for the wedding, get a bracha, whatever it was. And then they brought my parents to the back of 770. And my father's like, okay, you know, we're going to head over to back to my, you know, to Terry's parents, whatever. And, you know. He goes, oh, no, we have a wedding tonight. He's like, no, we got to go. Like, he said, no, you're getting married tonight. My parents got married in the back of 770. They slept my parents with a ksuba, halacha, because the wedding in the Reform Shul is going to be what? They said, you're not getting married there. You're going to have the ceremony there to honor your parents or whatever it is for the community. Hopefully you get good presents. He said, we're getting married tonight, here. And they brought him to Rabbi Zarchi of blessed memory. It was a dying in Crown Heights. Came, did the ksuba, explained what was going on. They were like, my father's wearing jeans. Mother's wearing like, you know, a regular like hippie dress. Mm-hmm. They like put something like a sweater on her. And like, you know, give my father a kittel and a gartel. And took him in the back room. They signed, they did the chuppah right out there in 770 with like a couple bachrim and a couple of the people dying there, a minion. Busted open a bottle of vodka and a jar of gefilte fish and a couple of challah rolls. Had sheva brachas there. Told my parents, go in the room 15 minutes. Like, I don't know, like my parents and father, like, what on earth is going on here? They weren't yet committed to Shmir Shabbos. They weren't yet committed to a life of Torah Mitzvahs. They were on the way. They were about derech, but the shlich said, this you're going to do right. My parents were like, all in. My mother asked that first Shabbos when they were married. The Rebbetzin gave her candlesticks. And she said to my father, I don't know how this, like, how are we going to do this? They weren't going to keep Shabbos. Like, their plan on Friday was not to do Shabbos. They hadn't, it wasn't like the plan. It wasn't a thing. Friday night was movies. Friday night they'd go out with friends, they'd go to concerts. And my father said, Led Zeppelin at the Singer Bowl. But they just gotten married. And they had Shabbos candles. My mother loved the idea of lighting Shabbos. They had Shabbos candles at the Chabad house. And Rebbetzin Gerari, Aleha Shalom, said to her, like my mother said, like, I don't know what to do. She was like very like torn by it. She felt like a hypocrite. How could I light Shabbos candles if, you know, I don't know, whatever, they're going to Led Zeppelin at the Singer Bowl, or going out to the mall, or going out with, I don't know, with my grandmother should be well. So whatever, the country club there in Sofron for drinks at the golf course or whatever it was that they were doing. And Rebbe Sengerari said, what does one thing have to do with the other? You're not going to light Shabbos candles because of what happens after. At that moment, at that juncture, you have a choice. You have a choice at that moment, as the sun goes down and Shabbos is beginning. Am I going to light candles or not? Am I going to illuminate the world? Am I going to fulfill this mitzvah? Am I going to bind myself to Hashem? Am I going to take part in the story of Jewish history? Am I going to take part in the transmission of Yiddishkeit in the world? Am I going to bring the world one step closer? Well, so she remembers. Am I going to bring the world one step closer to redemption by lighting these candles or not? That's the only thing you have to worry about at that moment. The context of it? What was she wearing? Where were they going afterwards? Was the food bichlal that they were going to eat that night kosher? Rebbetzin said, at that moment, just make that choice. Light the world up. Believe in that mitzvah. And mitzvah goreret mitzvah. When we believe in that mitzvah, as imperfect or as incomplete as it may be, it activates something inside of us. And the bigger we allow ourselves to be, the more we're able to see ourselves and others for their potential, not for our mistakes and our shortcomings, not in a narrow way, but in a big way. What can I become? What am I a part of? That's why we bind ourselves to the collective of the Jewish people before we daven. Take upon ourselves v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. We connect ourselves to the entirety of the Jewish people, because I know I fall short, but we complete each other, and together we form this incredible. We tap into this incredible infinite force called Ein Sof, called Nishmas Yisrael. And the bigger we are, the more we believe in those nekudos tovos. Just moving away for a moment, Kutamaran Memches. Moving away for a moment from that, and Gashmius isn't like some throwaway word like, oh, Gashmius eating doubles. Anything that drags us away from being a bigger version of ourselves. That's what Rabbi Nachman said. And just turning slightly. Gedola v'yekara ma'od ma'od. It's precious to Hashem very, very, very much. If we just allow ourselves to believe in that experience and to believe in that mitzvah, in that moment. Moshe Rabbeinu did. That's why he was afraid. I mean, you think of it, I don't know if there's a more incomplete, uglier solid that was done for another person in Tanakh. He was hoping that he would be killed, that he would steal his wife. Rape and murder. And generations later, Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned maybe that stands with him. I'll leave it this. How did the Rebbe have that? I mean, where did it come from? Where did it come from, this ability to just... The Rebbe didn't flinch. He didn't flinch. The Rebbe's not flinching until today. He's not mitbalbel from mistakes. Not mitbalbel from people who are in process. The greatest optimist of the generation. These incredible, you know, like these translation apps or that automatically take what you say and translate it into another language. The Rebbe took every situation, was able to translate it into something positive. He was able to take every person, everything, every place, that experience, and find within it the vitality, the heart, the essence, the divine spark, that which gives it real life, which is what it truly is. Light is stronger than darkness. And something good is stronger than something not good. We're all going to have to answer for what we've done and where we've fallen short. I mean, there's a process. There are books that describe this. I haven't learned them. But I know people who have. And they kind of say that it's real. That it's a real thing. You break it, you bought it, is actually a policy. And when we get to the next world, we're going to have to pay a price tag on a lot of the things that we said and did and didn't do. That's what's going to be. And there's a system for it. There's a system in the upper worlds. It's a court system and a judgment system. And we're going to have to send our clothing to the cleaners. And apparently it's not a very pleasant process. It's going to be something which ought to inspire a lot of intimidation and fear within us. And we don't focus on it that much, but it's also very true and it's very real. And it's also temporary. Because as true as it is that we make mistakes and we fail and we fall short, it's also true that the things that we do right and good are eternal. We're going to, like, you know, like, probably schnitzel on both sides. That is 11 months. Hopefully we'll have people say Kaddish for us and learn Torah, and we've left some impact in the world that'll stand for us and be left of us. Certainly not our money, and certainly not our accomplishments in sports, and certainly not how pretty your girlfriend is, or how many. It's ultimately going to be Torah and mitzvos and the good that we do in the world that stands for us eternally, and that goes forever. Netzach, netzach. It's true, we're going to have to pay. But light is stronger than darkness. The good lasts forever. And whatever that those nefarious intentions are, whatever that the og dikka elements in our avodas Hashem might be, in the end of the day, what lasts and what defines us is what's right and what's good. And the little things. The Rebbe told a story to his secretary, to tell the story to Rabbi Klein. He would often reference the story that took place when he was a young man. And his father-in-law, the previous Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe, at the end of his life, suffered tremendously, and he was in a wheelchair, and he'd suffered a stroke, and it was hard for him to communicate. But mentally and intellectually, he was fully cognizant, and he was totally with it, and he was stuck. The way Rav Aaron Soloveitchik describes himself being stuck within the hospital, the way he describes in Ravari's book on Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, describes like being stuck in this almost this prison cell of a body. That was the way the Friedrich Rebbe was. He couldn't move, and he had very little strength, but he was still the commander in chief of a global network of chadarim, of underground Torah in Tashkent and throughout the former Soviet Union, and also in America, all over the place, and mikvos, and he had ledgers and lists. And part of the Rebbe's job, part, he had two sons-in-law, and they each had different roles, different jobs, like overseeing the operations. And they would come in every morning after davening, they'd go to their shver for their father-in-law, and they would like go over the to-do list for the day and ask to get, you know, his approval, his bottom line. He was still running the show, even if he literally could barely lift his arm. But it was exhausting, and they were very careful with his respect, and they were very careful with his time. They never wanted to create any extra stress or any extra exertion. And it was the way that it was. They would come in after davening, and they would ask their questions in a very concise way, very carefully, one after the other. Right? They wouldn't schmooze, but they would ask. There's a cheder in Warsaw that needs a Rebbe. You know, should we move the person from Vienna? Should we tell them to move to Warsaw? Meaning it was a military operation. Chabad is the language of military operation. That's the way it works. There's six people in Moscow who are learning Tanya, and they want to know if they should start the second cycle again or if they should learn Torah or. And like that was the way that they was trying to like literally micromanaging chaburas and activities around the world. And they would ask the Friedrich Rebbe, and he would give instructions. And he insisted that it was done that way. Anyways, it was one of these mornings, and the Rashag, his brother-in-law, went through his list, and then the Rebbe went through his list. The Menachem Mendel, he was called the Ramash at that time. He was a young man. He went through his list. And they went through the list, and they saw that the Shver was exhausted, the Friedrich Rebbe was exhausted. He could barely move. So he started walking out the door. And as he got to the door to walk out, Rabbi Charakov was standing there, like as he was getting to the door, he goes, ah, like he kind of like made some kind of a gesture that like, oh, he had something else. So Rabbi Charakov said, go back in to ask your Shver, go back in to ask the Friedrich Rebbe, to the Rebbe, go back and ask the Rebbe. He said, no, it doesn't, tomorrow, it's okay, it can wait, it's not a big deal. So he goes, Rabbi Charakov was older, he said, the Rebbe probably wants to talk to you about it now. And he said, he's done, he's already closed his eyes and he's slumped back in his chair, couldn't move. He said, it'll wait till tomorrow. Again, Charakov said, I think that the Rebbe would probably want you to. So the Ramash, Rav Menachem Mendel, turned around and he went back to his father-in-law and he said, in Shuldig, to his father-in-law, he said, excuse me, to the Rebbe. And Rebbe kind of like, you know, opened one of his eyes. Half his face was paralyzed. He barely opened his eyes. And Menachem Mendel said, I'm sorry, I have just one more thing, just like one more kleinigkeit, one more small thing to ask. And his father-in-law, the previous Rebbe, like said, nein, no. So he said, okay, I got it, no problem. So he started like walking out to the door. And then he, on the top of his lungs, said, nein, no. So I bless you all to have these moments with your in-laws that you're like, okay, wait, what do I do? Yes, no, like, am I coming in? Am I going out? Like, what do you want? Like, am I, what do I do here? You know what I'm saying? Like, What do I call you? What do I do? Do I move my chair to get your attention? Like, what do I do? He was frozen. He said he was frozen. Friedrich Rebbe turned to him and said, nein, no. This is netto kein Kleinigkeit. There's no such thing as something small. Rebbe said, I have like one small thing to clarify. And he said, no, there's no such thing as something small. And this, Rabbi Klein, the Rebbe's secretary, would say, changed his whole perspective. And when it comes to being in the service of Klal Yisrael, when it comes to the world of Yiddishkeit, the learning, the Torah, mitzvahs, chesed, tzedakah, there's no such thing as something small. Something small sets a chain reaction of events in the world that we have no idea what kind of impact that'll have. We have no idea what can it affect. Yukachna ma'at ma'im. The Avim says to the guests, take a little bit of water, v'rachatzu aglechem, come sit over here, wash yourselves, come sit over here. Measures. The Gemara says that because of that we were zochel to the Be'er Shel Miriam, give a little bit of food to these dirty travelers, and we had the man in the wilderness. The impact that a little bit can have in a way that we'll never know for ourselves and for the world. But it only comes from believing in a little bit. It only comes from having that bigger vision of ourselves and of the world. Believing in light stronger than darkness. Believing in those Shabbos candles or in that tefillin, in that mincha, that you know you're not going to pay. You know it's not happening. We've all had those minchas. Or you have that shachris where you realize, I forgot the alviyah, I got to do that, bang out that second Shemona Esrei, but like, oh my God, that second Shemona Esrei. We all know what that second Shemona Esrei looks like. I don't know, we all. I know what that looks like very much. But there are those of us who know what a slach lano feels like on a Friday night. On a Shavuos morning, sometimes our service that we intend big things for, sometimes it falls short. Just remember, we're not as bad as Og. Not looking to kill anybody and take their wife, I assume. I imagine not if you're learning here in this wonderful kollel. And realize how much kavod Moshe Rabbeinu gave, how much stock he put in that, how much value he put in that, how much he feared that the schus of that imperfect, incomplete mitzvah. And for us, how much to be mechabed our own efforts and our own ritzonos, to give ourselves a little bit of credit for the good that we're trying to do in the world. And to believe in that, and to believe in that, and to believe in that. Because it's very, very valuable to Hashem. It's gedola yikara hi ma'od ma'od. Cool.